He took her organs out and examined them, hanging them on nearby branches so he could see them better. She was not found until several months had gone by, and by then only her skeleton remained. Therefore, the first and second murders were not considered linked by the police. Mullen was a disorganized offender, and I have said that disorganized offenders don't drive cars, but Mullen did. That just goes to prove that every single attribute on our list does not apply to every single killer. In a sense, that's why profiling remains an art and not a science, and why we resist our students' wishes that we profilers provide them with a checklist that would make easy their own assessments of crime scenes. Although Mullen differs slightly from the classic disorganized killer in being able to drive a car, he shares many of the other characteristics of the disorganized offender: the chance victim, the chance weapon, the mutilation of the body, and no real attempt to hide the body or prevent identification. The reason that the second victim was not found until months later was pure luck, not something that happened as a result of planning or guile by the murderer. On a Thursday afternoon, 4 days after cutting up the young hitchhiker in the woods, Mullen appeared to have doubts about the appropriateness of what he believed to be his father's instructions, so he went to see a Catholic priest in a confessional booth at a church 15 miles from Santa Cruz. As Mullen later related the incident, he told the priest about the sacrifice program and that his father had told him to start on it and to take certain victims. The priest asked him, "Herbert, do you read the Bible?" "Yes." "The commandments, where it says to honor thy father and mother?" "Yes," Mullen responded. "Then you know how important it is to do as your father says." "Yes." "I think it's so important," the priest said, in Mullen's recollection of the encounter, "that I want to volunteer to be your next sacrifice." Mullen kicked and hit and stabbed the priest a half dozen times, then left him bleeding to death in the confessional booth and rushed away. A parishioner saw the struggle and the assailant and ran for help. Mullen escaped, and the priest died, but the parishioner gave a description of the killer to the police. Unfortunately, it described the killer as tall as well as thin, and so was not much help in the investigation. Brooding, Mullen tried to figure out what had gone wrong in his life, and his thoughts came to center on the time in high school when a teammate first gave him marijuana to smoke. As he became more and more mentally ill, Mullen had actually stopped using drugs and now had taken to blaming them for his problems. In early January 1973, he went to a remote area of cabins without telephones on the outskirts of Santa Cruz, where he thought the teammate might still reside. He went to the door of a house occupied by a woman who lived there with her common-law husband and children. The husband was involved in selling illegal drugs, but was not home. The woman answered the door and told Mullen that the man he wanted to see lived down the road. In his memory, she also insisted to him that she and the children would like to volunteer as human sacrifices, as the priest had. He killed them all with a pistol. Then he knocked on the door of the football teammate's home. The former teammate invited Mullen in, and a confrontation began. This man, too, was now a drug dealer, and drug paraphernalia lay about the house. The teammate was unable to answer questions about why he had ruined Mullen's life with an early toke of pot, so Mullen shot him. Dying, the man crawled upstairs and into the bathroom where his wife was in the shower. He shouted for her to lock the door, but Mullen broke it down and fatally shot her, too. When police found 5 people dead in 2 neighboring homes and learned that the men had been involved in the drug trade, they thought the murders were drug-related, a deal gone wrong, revenge being wrought. They did not suspect these killings to be connected in any way to the death of the priest or of the 2 hitchhikers. A month later, Mullen was in a redwood forest area and walked in on 4 male teenagers in a tent. He asked them their business, and they said they were camping. He claimed to be a forest ranger and said that they were polluting the forest and ought to leave. Moreover, the campsite was not in an area that was legal for camping. The 4 young men shooed Mullen away. The presence of their .22 rifle in the tent may have helped them do so. He said he'd come back the next day to see whether they had gone. The teenagers remained in the tent. Next day, Mullen came back and killed them all with the .22. They were not found until the following week. By that time, Mullen had killed again and had been apprehended. His father's supposed instructions to kill came to her while he was driving his station wagon with a load of firewood in it. He noticed an Hispanic man weeding his garden across the street. He made a U-turn, came back down the street, stopped, took out the rifle, put it across the hood of the car, and shot the man. He committed this murder in full sight of the dead man's neighbor, who managed to write down the license plate number of the station wagon as Mullen calmly drove away from the scene of the crime. Within minutes of the description being put out on the police radio, a patrolman spotted Mullen driving down a road, ordered him to pull over, and arrested him. When apprehended, he was docile and did not attempt to grab or use the recently fired rifle on the seat next to him. Also in the station wagon was the .22 pistol that had been used several weeks earlier to kill the people in the cabins. Mullen's disorganized characteristics were apparent by his demeanor in court. He had to be restrained by chains, and he submitted rambling written discourses to the judge that had nothing to do with the matters at hand, and in the way he had behaved during those 4 months in which he executed 13 people. The logic that connected these murders existed only in his tormented brain. However, the jury judged him to have been legally sane at the time of the murders and convicted him on all counts. When I attempted to interview Mullen in prison, I found him docile, polite, and handsome, but uncommunicative. Every few minutes as I tried to question him, he would ask, "Sir, can I go back to my room now?" He stated that he had committed his crimes only in an attempt to save the environment. Mullen displayed all the signs of serious mental illness. That he was in a penitentiary with career criminals was ridiculous at best and unwise. He should have been in a mental institution. Organized and disorganized, two types of killers. Which are the more prevalent and dangerous? That's hard to answer, but perhaps we can approach an answer by means of our research and some educated guesses about modern society. Our research into murderers is acknowledged to be the most broad-based yet completed. In it, we judged 2/3 of the murderers to be in the organized category as opposed to 1/3 in the disorganized. Perhaps those ratios carry through in the overall population of killers, only some of whom are behind bars, as our interviewees were. My guess is that there has always been a certain unchanging fraction of disorganized killers in society from the earliest days until the present, men who are quite deranged and who now and again go on killing sprees that stop only when they are caught or killed. We can't do much about the disorganized murderers. There'll probably always be one or two among us. It is my sincere belief, however, that the number and percentage of organized killers are growing. As our society grows more mobile, and as the availability of weapons of mass destruction increases, the ability of the antisocial personality to realize his rapacious and murderous fantasies grows apace. 7. What plus why equals who? When I arrived at the Behavioral Sciences Unit in 1974, I became an apprentice in profiling to the Mutt and Jeff team of Howard Teton and Pat Mullaney. Mullaney, a former Christian Brother, had been at the task since 1972, and Teton, a former San Leandro, California Evidence Unit specialist, had been working on profiling since 1969. Teton, in turn, had received guidance from a psychiatrist in New York, Dr. James A. Brussel, who had astounded the country in 1956 with a prediction about the personality of a mad bomber who had left 32 explosive packages in New York City over a period of 8 years. Brussel studied crime scenes, messages from the bomber, and other information, and had told the police they would find an Eastern European immigrant in his 40s who lived with his mother in a Connecticut city. The psychiatrist said the man was very neat. he deduced from the way the bomber rounded off the points of his W's that he adored his mother. The rounded W's looked like bosoms, and hated his father. Brussel even predicted that the bomber, when arrested, would be wearing a double-breasted suit, neatly buttoned. When taken into custody, George Metesky was indeed wearing a buttoned, double-breasted suit, and fit the profile in many other regards, except for the fact that he resided with two unmarried sisters rather than with his mother. Profiling had somewhat fallen into disrepute during the 1960s, when a committee of psychiatrists and psychologists guessed very incorrectly about the identity of the Boston Strangler, but the need for profiling kept growing because violent crimes against strangers, the most difficult of all crimes to solve, kept increasing in number. In the 1960s, in the majority of murder cases, the killer had some relationship with his or her victim. By the 1980s, some 25% of murders were stranger murders, in which the killer did not really know the victim. The reasons for the steady rise in the statistics, sociologists believed, could be found in the sort of society we had become. Mobile, in many ways impersonal, flooded with images of violence and of heightened sexuality. Profiling was even less of a science then. It was an art that had to be painstakingly learned over a period of years by means of an apprenticeship. Even in the FBI, it was not a regular bureaucratically designed activity, but, rather, one that was pursued by a handful of people when local police would see fit to refer a case to us that seemed beyond their own capabilities, or when an officer was smart enough to know when he or she needed help. I was fortunate to begin in profiling as Teton and Mullaney tackled a difficult case. Pete Dunbar, an agent in the Bozeman, Montana office, brought to our attention an unsolved kidnapping in that state. The previous June, while the Yeager family of Farmington, Michigan, had been on a camping trip, someone had put a knife through the fabric of a tent and snatched away their 7-year-old daughter, Susan. Teton and Mullaney had put together a preliminary profile of the likely suspect in the kidnapping. They thought it was a young white male who lived in the area, a loner who had come across the family during a night walk. The profilers concluded that Susan was probably dead, though when no body was found, the family continued to hold out hope. Dunbar had a logical suspect, a 23-year-old Vietnam veteran named David Meyerhofer. An informant had provided the name, and it happened that Dunbar was acquainted with Meyerhofer, whom he characterized as well-groomed, courteous, exceptionally intelligent, polite. Meyerhofer was a good match with the Teton-Mullaney profile, but there was no evidence to tie him to the abduction, and he was not charged with the crime. The Yeagers went back to Michigan to resume their lives, and Dunbar went on to other work. In January of 1974, however, an 18-year-old woman who had rejected Meyerhofer as a suitor was also missing from the Bozeman area, and Meyerhofer was again a logical suspect. He volunteered to take a lie detector test and to be given truth serum. He passed both those tests in regard to both crimes, and his attorney pressed for Meyerhofer to be unconditionally released and for the authorities to keep away from him. However, more information was obtained from the second crime, and this enabled the profilers, myself included, now as a neophyte, to refine the profile. It pointed to the sort of person Meyerhofer was, and the fact that this suspect had been able to get past the truth serum and polygraph tests did not sway us. The public thinks these tests are a good way to discern the truth, and that is so for most normal people. Psychopaths, however, are known for their ability to separate the personality who commits the crimes from their more in-control selves. Thus, when a psychopath takes these tests, the in-control self manages to avoid all knowledge of the crimes, and very often the result is that the suspect passes the tests. Meyerhofer was in control at some times, and at others horrendously out of control. We convinced Dunbar that Meyerhofer had to be the killer, and that even though he had passed the tests, Dunbar should not let the matter go. Teton and Mullaney thought that the killer might well be the sort of man who telephones the relatives of his victims in order to relive the crime and its excitement. Accordingly, Dunbar asked the Yeagers to keep a tape recorder next to their telephone. On the first anniversary of the 7-year-old's abduction, Mrs. Yeager answered a call at her Michigan home from a man who claimed he was keeping Susan alive. "He was very smug and taunting," Mrs. Yeager later told a reporter. The unknown man said that he had spirited Susan away to a country in Europe and was giving her a better life than the Yeagers could have afforded to give her. "My reaction was not what he was expecting," Mrs. Yeager recalled. "I felt truly able to forgive him. I had a great deal of compassion and concern, and that really took him aback. He let his guard down and finally just broke down and wept." The caller did not admit that Susan was dead and hung up before the call could be traced. An FBI voice analyst went over the tape and concluded that the taunting voice had been David Meyerhofer's. However, the analyst's evidence was not then considered sufficient in a Montana court to obtain a search warrant of a suspect's premises, so the authorities had no way of getting at Meyerhofer. Dunbar spent some time tracing the call. It seemed to have come from an open area, possibly from someone tapping into a phone line on poles above a neighboring ranch. Dunbar traced Meyerhofer's service record and learned that Meyerhofer had learned to tap into field telephone wires in Vietnam. However, this, too, was not hard evidence. Mullaney listened to the tape of the Yeager-Meyerhofer conversation and initiated a bold move. "I felt that Meyerhofer could be woman-dominated," he later recalled. "I suggested that Mrs. Yeager go to Montana and confront him." She did so at his lawyer's office in Montana, but Meyerhofer was calm and collected, very much in control of his emotions. Shortly after Mrs. Yeager returned to Michigan, though, she received a collect telephone call from a Mr. Travis in Salt Lake City. Travis wanted to explain that he, not someone else, had taken Susan. Before the caller could go on, Mrs. Yeager interrupted him and said, "Well, hello, David." Now Dunbar had enough evidence, in the form of an affidavit from Mrs. Yeager, to obtain a search warrant of Meyerhofer's premises, and, in them, found remains of both female victims. Meyerhofer was confronted with these remains and other evidence, and confessed not only to those two murders, but also to the previously unsolved killing of at least one local Montana boy. After the confession, Meyerhofer was put into a cell alone, and the next day he hung himself. There was no doubt in our minds that the profile put together at Quantico had helped solve the case. If there had been no profile, Dunbar would have had no reason to be quite so interested in a suspect named by an informant. Later, after the second murder, and after Meyerhofer had passed the polygraph and truth serum tests, the Quantico profile assisted Dunbar in sticking with the case and firming up his inner conviction that Meyerhofer was the culprit. Finally, Mullaney's guess that Meyerhofer could be swayed by Mrs. Yeager because of his confused psychological responses to women was the blow that finally cracked open the killer's defenses. This early case demonstrated to me both the power and the possibilities in profiling. Profiling had helped identify the most likely suspect and had given the agent in the field reason to keep after him, even when many factors argued against continuing to do so. Moreover, the Meyerhofer case showed that the more experience we had and the more information about violent criminals we amassed and comprehended, the better we would become at profiling. No two crimes, or criminals, are exactly alike. The profiler looks for patterns in the crimes and tries to come up with the characteristics of the likely offender. It's fact-based and uses analytical and logical thinking processes. We learn all we can from what has happened, use our experience to fathom the probable reasons why it happened, and from these factors draw a portrait of the perpetrator of the crime. In a nutshell, what plus why equals who? The real task is to whittle down the universe of potential suspects, to eliminate the least likely ones and allow the on-site investigators to focus on realistic targets. Thus, if we are able to say with a high degree of probable accuracy that the suspect in a crime is a male, we've eliminated about 50% of the population who are not males. The category adult males is a smaller fraction of the population, single white males an even smaller number. By making such choices, we very quickly narrow the search. Every added category makes the band of possible suspects slimmer. For instance, we might suggest that the likely criminal is unemployed, or one who has previously received treatment for mental disease, or that it is a person who lives within walking distance of the crime scene. I taught class after class at Quantico and did roadshows about profiling, and I found that no matter how intensively we tried to instill the principles in our students, they wanted more direction. Didn't we have a workbook from which they could learn what questions to ask, to figure out what characteristics of a crime scene were the most important? Police officers, and even our in-service agents, wanted a checklist so they could profile, as it were, by the numbers. Put in this and that detail of evidence from the crime scene, push a button or apply a formula, and have a perfect profile pop out. In the future, we hope to have a computer program that can perform in that way, but we've been working on it for a half dozen years and haven't perfected it yet. Profiling is still best done by people with a lot of experience, particularly by those who have studied psychology. And there's a lot of work involved, work in the sense of applying one's brain to what is usually a complex puzzle. At the heart of the puzzle is the crime scene, which generally contains the best evidence that is available to us. We try to analyze it exhaustively, in an attempt both to understand the crime and, by reflection, the nature of the person who committed it. A good example is that rooftop in the Bronx where a special education teacher was murdered. Virtually everything at the site came from the victim: the handbag used to strangle her, the comb placed in her pubic hair, even the felt pen with which the killer wrote obscenities on her body. That proved to be important in assessing what sort of a killer this might be. We thought it was a person who hadn't planned the crime, that it might have been somewhat spontaneous. In other instances, an abductor might bring with him what we have come to call a rape kit, with tape, ropes, and possibly a gun, all of which could be used to control a victim. As I reported briefly in an earlier chapter, the absence of such a rape kit was a factor in another classic murder case in which I became involved as a profiler. The thoughtful listener would surmise that a city the size and sophistication of New York would catch on quite early to the idea of psychological profiling as an investigative aid. But that sort of acceptance had to wait a while, until we had helped to unravel this particularly perplexing murder of the young special education teacher. On an October afternoon, the nude body of this young woman was found on the roof of the Bronx public housing project in which she lived. Francine Elverson had been a small woman, under 5 feet tall and weighing less than 100 pounds. She lived with her mother and father in an apartment in that building and had not been seen since early morning when she had left for her job teaching handicapped children at a nearby daycare center. Her body was arranged in an odd, almost unnatural position that made no sense until investigators described it to her parents, who told them it resembled the letter Chai of the Hebrew alphabet, the letter that had been on a chain she had worn around her neck. The chain was missing from the scene. This, however, was not an anti-Semitic crime, but a brutal sexual murder. On either side of the victim's head, the killer had placed the earrings she had worn. Her nylons were tied loosely around her wrists, and her underpants had been removed and pulled over her head to cover her face. The rest of Francine's clothing lay nearby, and under it was the place where the killer had defecated. The young teacher had been beaten about the face, strangled with the strap of her purse, and severely mutilated after death. Her nipples had been cut off and placed on her chest. There was a lot of blood smeared about, bite marks on her inner thighs, an umbrella and a pen had been jammed into her vagina, and a comb was entwined in her pubic hair. The killer had written on her thigh and abdomen in ink, "Fuck you, you can't stop me." Semen and a single black pubic hair, not the victim's, had also been found on her body. That hair served to lead the police astray for some time. When New York Housing Authority homicide detective Thomas Foley got around to sending us the crime scene photos and other investigative information, the police had 22 suspects, some of them quite promising. That wasn't surprising because New York is a very large city in population as well as in area, and there are a lot of strange, potentially violent people within that number. For instance, one obvious suspect was a man who lived in the building and who had previously been incarcerated for sex offenses. Another was a black man who had formerly been a janitor in the building and had never turned in his keys. A third was a 15-year-old boy who found Francine's wallet on the stairs in the morning as he was on his way to school, but did not give it to his father to return until later in the day. I looked at the crime scene photos and the other evidence and concluded that the black pubic hair was irrelevant. Another profiler disagreed with me, but I argued that this was a crime of a mentally ill person. The level of violence to the body showed that. The absence of a rape kit showed a lack of complete premeditation and stalking. Real stalkers bring with them the things they need to restrain the victim. This was clearly a spontaneous, blitz-style assault, committed during a chance encounter between killer and victim. Though the scene had been made to appear a bit as if a gang had done this, I thought not. Our profile told Foley that he ought to be looking for a white male, aged 25 to 35, who knew the victim and lived and worked either in that very building or in one that was nearby. I thought it likely that the killer was mentally ill and, as with Richard Chase, the disease had been bubbling within him for 10 years before it had erupted into a mutilation murder. Most people who have full-blown mental illness do not range far from their homes to commit this sort of crime, and that was why I thought it probable that he lived nearby, either alone or with an indulgent single parent. The notes and arranging of the body suggested that this was not a well-schooled man, probably a school dropout who had gotten his ideas on what to say in his note and how to mutilate the body from an extensive collection of pornographic materials. Because I felt certain that he had a history of mental disease, I thought it likely that he had been released by some mental care institution within the past year. I also suggested that there would be severe pre-crime stresses that might have provoked the murder. Given the level of police work that had already been put in, we all concluded that the cops had probably already interrogated the killer. This profile enabled Foley and his men to refocus their investigation. They could put the former janitor on the shelf for a while, since we said the crime had been committed by a white man, and they could also more or less eliminate the man who had had prior sex crime offenses, who was now happily married, employed, and considered as having put his past behind him. Another suspect who had been previously dismissed could now be brought to the fore, however. Earlier, the police had spoken to a man who lived on the fourth floor of the building, the same floor as the victim, and shared the apartment with his son, who had been in a mental institution. The mother had died when Carmine Calabro was 19 years old, and that was 11 years earlier. When interviewed in October, the father said that Carmine had been in the institution at the time of the murder, and the police had not triple-checked this alibi. Now it was scrutinized more closely. Calabro was a high school dropout who had spent more than a year in a nearby mental hospital, then had gotten a job as a stagehand from which he had recently been fired. He had first told police that he was an unemployed actor, but he later admitted to being an unemployed stagehand. The Calabro's apartment was full of pornography. When the police looked into the security at the mental hospital, they discovered that it was so lax it would easily have been possible for Carmine to have slipped out of the institution, committed the murder, and returned without anyone having noticed he had been gone or being able to say that he had been absent. At the time of the murder, he had been wearing a cast on his arm, and it was surmised that he had used this cast to render the victim unconscious. By the time the police caught up to him, the cast had long since been thrown away. Fortunately, it was not needed to prove that the former mental patient was the killer. One of the key clues came from the victim's body. She had been bitten. Three forensic odontologists, including Dr. Lowell Levine, were able to match the bite marks to the prime suspect's teeth, and the case was solved. Calabro was convicted and sentenced to 25 years to life. Further investigation revealed that this former stagehand had a long history of violence toward himself, including repeated suicide attempts, and was described by many people as being insecure with women. His inability to connect with a woman seems to have been the starting point of the crime. It turned out that Elverson's body had been transported to the medical examiner in a body bag that had previously been used for a black male and had not been properly cleaned before transport. The unexplained pubic hair had come from that earlier murder, not from Elverson's body at all. When the Elverson Calabro case was all over, Lieutenant Joseph D'Amico, Foley's boss and a former student of mine at Quantico, told a reporter, "They, the profilers, had him, the suspect, so right that I asked the FBI why they hadn't given us his phone number, too." While we liked that compliment, we liked even better the fact that this case helped open the eyes of New York's police community to the idea of profiling as a way of narrowing the field of suspects in a difficult case. In court, Calabro never admitted his crime. However, after an article including information about the BSU's profile of the case had appeared in the magazine Psychology Today, an article that did not mention the name of the killer or of the victim, Calabro wrote us a letter. That he would write to us directly and make reference to the case summarized in the article was as much an admission of guilt as he ever made. The letter said that some points in our psychological profile, I personally believe, are correct. I was on the interstate, traveling in a bureau car to Richmond, Virginia, to give a lecture, when a call came over the FBI radio asking me to turn around and return to Quantico. When I protested that I was expected to show up and talk to a prestigious group, I was informed that I was needed because President Reagan had been assassinated. I turned around. On the way back, I tuned in to commercial radio stations, from which I learned the good news that the president had been shot but was alive and expected to recover, as were the other victims. Driving back, I alternated between listening intently to the reports and churning over in my mind some details of my earlier interviews with such assassins as Sirhan Sirhan and would-be assassins as Arthur Bremmer and Sarah Jane Moore. My visit with Arthur Bremmer had been almost a carbon copy of the one I'd had with Sirhan. The two were two peas in a behavioral pod, paranoid schizophrenics to the core. Bremmer had been bizarre in appearance, something like Howard Hughes in his reclusive state, wild hair, flowing beard, his eyes darting about. He carried with him two shopping bags that contained all of his earthly belongings. Yet Bremmer had seemed somewhat in control of his actions at the time of his attempts on the life of Governor George Wallace. I thought also on this ride back to Quantico of David Berkowitz, who was not an assassin, but who had many of the personality characteristics that I associate with assassins. He had stalked a particular type of victim, much as Bremmer had stalked Wallace. At Quantico, I went to Assistant Director McKenzie's office, where it was obvious that I had been expected, and I was put on the hotline to headquarters, where I spoke with Frank W. Weikart, the agent who had been put in charge of the case. Weikart told me that the authorities already had John Hinckley in custody and needed some assistance on what to look for when they searched his motel room. I asked for whatever details he could provide me about Hinckley. The FBI had worked quickly. My colleagues already knew that Hinckley was a white male in his mid-twenties. They learned he was single, a college student from Denver, and that his family appeared to be fairly wealthy. After his shooting spree, he had submitted rather easily to the Secret Service and other agents who immobilized him, and now appeared to be calm. The FBI had the key to his motel room, but the motel and room had also been discovered by the press, and the authorities were nearly having to beat off the press to prevent unauthorized people from entering and trashing the assassin's quarters. Although Hinckley was in custody, many, many things could go wrong in this stage of the investigation, when the shock and panic had not worn off. First of all, Washington, D.C. is a multi-jurisdictional area, and lots of different police authorities might want to push their way in and seize evidence. There was the extreme danger that if the evidence was not properly seized, it could be thrown out in court, and that might put the entire prosecution of Hinckley in jeopardy. What was essential was to get a search warrant that listed items for which the prosecution would specifically look. It must not seem as if the search was a random one. What was required then was more than a profile. It was a journey into the mind of this assassin to see who he might be, and what evidence of that personality he might have left around him. I told Weikart that all the facts he had given me pointed toward the notion that Hinckley was a mentally disordered type of assassin, though not so disordered as to be actually beyond understanding what he had done or what was happening to him. I did not see him as a paid assassin or as part of a conspiracy, but rather as a loner, an introvert. He would be the type, often recognized on college campuses, who had no successful relationships with women, didn't fit into the dating scene, wasn't a member of sports teams or even of clubs, the sort of person who wasn't very good academically and who found his rewards in fantasy. And so I told Weikart to look in Hinckley's motel room and his car and his Denver home for evidence of such loneliness and fantasy. The searchers should seize materials that were reflections of the fantasy, diaries, scrapbooks, reading material. I cautioned Weikart to seize all reading material, no matter how innocuous it might appear, because it would be a window into Hinckley's personality. There might be, for instance, magazine articles or books where specific passages were underlined, and the underlining would tell us what Hinckley thought was significant. High up on my list of what to look for was a tape recorder and audio tapes, because this sort of lonely person often makes audio tapes and uses them as a sort of diary. Another important item would be credit cards and receipts, because we'd need to trace his steps back at least 6 months, and possibly as long as a year. Assassins such as Bremer had stalked their targets, and I thought it likely that Hinckley had also done so. Hotel bills might contain records of phone calls. He might even have a telephone credit card that we could use to find additional records of his movements and interests. My list of a dozen items was turned into a search warrant listing those items and was used by the authorities to seize items from Hinckley's motel room and other rooms used by him. Nearly every item I had suggested as important was found. For example, there were tapes of his conversations with Jodie Foster. There was a postcard with a picture of the Reagans that Hinckley had addressed to Foster with this text. "Dear Jodie, don't they make a darling couple? Nancy is downright sexy. One day you and I will occupy the White House and the peasants will drool with envy. Until then, please do your best to remain a virgin. You are a virgin, aren't you? John Hinckley." He hadn't sent the postcard, but he had written it. Another item seized was a letter to Foster that said he was going out to shoot Reagan and knew he might not return, but that he wanted her to know he had done this deed for her. This letter, among other items, was evidence of a premeditated attack against Reagan and of the fact that he knew what he was doing was legally wrong. There were diaries and comments in the margins of papers. One read, "Everything whirls, and still the young girls laugh and mock my name." There was an annotated copy of the script of Taxi Driver, the film about an assassin in which Jodie Foster had starred. All of this material fit quite well with my snap evaluation of John Hinckley as a loner who was unsuccessful with women and who lived in a fantasy world. One thing we in law enforcement are never able to forget is that murder is a horrific crime that scars the family, friends, and associates of the victim. This bedrock belief was all the more reason for me to feel the necessity of doing what I could to help when a call came from Dr. James Cavanaugh in Chicago. Years earlier, I had enlisted Dr. Cavanaugh as an advisor to my criminal personality research project. He was medical director of the Isaac Ray Center of Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center in Chicago, which deals in forensic psychiatric issues. One of Kavanaugh's medical students, a young woman named Lori Rossetti, had been found murdered at the side of some railroad tracks not far from the medical center. Rossetti had been a bright, gentle, straight-A student who had just finished a campaign to reinstate a campus escort service for women, which had been dropped as a result of a budget crunch. Her efforts had failed. Lori was liked by everyone at the center, and the staff and Kavanaugh were quite upset by her death. The formal request for my presence was initiated by Tom Cronin, a Chicago police officer who had been a police fellow at the FBI Academy and a student of mine. Tom sent me a batch of materials. He facetiously noted that a reward for information leading to the arrest of the murderer had already reached $45,000, of which half would be mine if we did a good profile. In the middle of serious business, law enforcement people often try to maintain a level head by making jokes. We are, of course, precluded from seeking or accepting monetary rewards. From the materials, I learned that the young student had been studying in a room with several others until about 1:30 a.m. on a Saturday in October. She and a male student had gone down to the garage to get her car, carrying books and bags, and she had then driven the male student up to another level of the garage, where he got out of the car and slammed the door. She must have assumed the door was locked, since that male student and others had told the police that Lori was always quite conscientious about such matters. The medical center was in a bad neighborhood at the edge of the University of Illinois Circle campus, and she was always cautious about traveling to and from the area. At 5:30 that same morning, her body and her car were found next to a railroad trestle adjoining an impoverished black community, and not more than a half mile from the hospital. The medical examiner's report showed that she had been badly beaten about the face, that there were considerable trauma injuries to her midsection, and that she had been repeatedly sexually assaulted. It seemed that her car had actually been driven over her body. The doors and trunk of the car were open, and her empty wallet was found on the scene. The police had no suspects, but were interested in a young man who had been a platonic friend of the victim's. He had sought a closer relationship with her and had been spurned, but he had been unexpectedly in town on Friday night and on the morning of the murder. They were also looking into her relationships at the medical center, focusing, for instance, on a janitor who had access to the garage, as well as canvassing in the area where she lived. They were attempting to trace people who drove trucks near the railroad tracks and a nearby viaduct, in short, going out in all directions. In terms of profiling, the case was easy, and after viewing aerial photos of the crime scene area, the medical examiner's report, and all the other documents, I gave an oral profile to Tom Cronin at his home. My guess was based on what I thought was likely to have happened after Rossetti had left the garage. She had probably stopped at a light in this run-down district, and some people had come up to her, blocked the car, and one had pulled a door, which happened to be open, even though she had thought it was locked. These people then forced her to drive to the somewhat isolated location where they had raped, killed, and robbed her. To my mind, this had been an opportunistic crime. The attempt to rob had been the primary motivator, and the sexual assault was secondary. The murder had probably been committed to prevent the victim from identifying her attackers, and it reflected the psychopathic nature of the group of attackers. The presence of a good deal of seminal fluid made it likely that there had been more than one killer. It had all the hallmarks of a gang event. I told the police to look for a group of black youths, somewhere between 3 and 6 males, ranging in age from 15 to 20, who would previously have been in jail and who lived close by the scene of the abduction and the railroad trestle where Rossetti had been killed. In white middle-class neighborhoods, kids tend to hang out in single-age groups, all 15-year-olds, for example, or all 18-year-olds, but in black neighborhoods there is often a mixture of ages, with young ones accompanying older ones. The murder took place well before the rape of the jogger in Central Park by a bunch of kids who had gone wilding. If I had known the term wilding then, I would have used it to describe what I thought had happened in the murder of Lori Rossetti. The anal assault convinced me that at least some of the gang members had already been incarcerated, because such assaults are common in prisons. Was this an obvious profile? Yes and no. As I indicated earlier, the police were intensely investigating people linked personally to Rossetti, and continuing on that path would have taken them further and further astray. The profile allowed the police to refocus the investigation, and thereby sped up the case. Armed with the profile and the lure of reward money for information, police put the word out on the streets of the black neighborhoods adjoining the crime sites that they were looking for young black men who had bragged of taking money from a woman medical student or of doing anything else associated with Rossetti's murder. The community rather readily came up with a number of nicknames, Shimsham was one, that were tracked down, and youngsters were hauled in for questioning. The youngest of the four suspects was 14. Interrogated, he admitted to the crime, as did two other perpetrators aged 17 and 16. Between them, these latter two already had more than 24 arrests and convictions for previous offenses, and both had served time in youth reformatories. A fourth youth was still being sought when the whole story emerged. After a night out, the foursome had run out of money and were looking for a car to rob. They waited about 15 minutes until they saw a car with a lone white female stopped at a light. Two had stood in front of the car, betting that the driver wouldn't run them over, while another tried the doors. Finding a door open, he climbed into it and opened the other doors for his companions. After that, the foursome had driven Rossetti to the trestle site, where they stabbed her with a sharpened stick she had kept in the car for protection, and had put her over the hood of the car and raped her before beating her into unconsciousness. When she stirred again, they smashed in her head with a piece of concrete wrapped in a plastic bag and ran her car over her body. Then the attackers had walked to the Abla projects where three of them lived and where the fourth used to reside. The fourth suspect, 18, eventually surrendered in the custody of a local television newsman who was known for such assistance. Later, several of the suspects tried to recant their early confessions and claimed these had been coerced by the police. The jury evidently didn't believe the recantations, and all four were convicted. Three were sent to prison, and the youngest to a youth facility. The escort system Laurie had fought for was reinstated. Neither the convictions nor the beefed-up security brought Laurie Rossetti back, of course, but the law's vengeance and the future protection of other potential victims were the only solace available to the community, to Laurie's family and friends, and to Dr. Kavanaugh and the staff of the medical center. Many of the cases that the FBI profiles have to do with offenders who have already been caught, but whose crimes are so unusual that the local authorities seek guidance on how to proceed. One morning during Thanksgiving week of November 1985, a teenaged girl, nude, handcuffs on hands and feet, and quite weak from loss of blood, crawled along a road near Malabar, Florida, seeking help. Several trucks passed her by, but then a motorist stopped. "You're not going to take me back to that house, are you?" the terrified girl asked. The motorist responded that he would help her and got her into the car. She asked him to remember that house, which she pointed out to him a few doors away, a place with a well-kept lawn, many trees, a swimming pool and patio. The motorist took her home and called the police and an ambulance. At the hospital, it was determined that she had lost between 40% and 45% of her blood, and that there were ligature marks on her neck as well as on her hands and ankles. As she recovered, the 19-year-old told the police that one day earlier she had been hitchhiking in Brevard County on her way to a friend's home and had been picked up by a man wearing a sport coat and a tie. He offered to take her most of the way, but said he had to stop at his home and pick something up. At the house, he asked the hitchhiker to come inside. When she said no, he went around to the back of the car, got in behind her, and threw a nylon rope around her and choked her into unconsciousness. The hitchhiker woke to find that she was tied to a kitchen countertop, arms and legs immobilized. A video camera had been set up, along with lights. The man raped her and videotaped the action. Then he inserted needles into her arm and wrist and carefully extracted blood and began to drink it, telling her that he was a vampire. After that, he handcuffed her and put her in the bathtub, returning later for another round of sexual assault and blood extraction. The next morning, after a third round, the man handcuffed the hitchhiker and left her in the bathroom, saying that he would be back later for further assaults, and that if she tried to escape in the interim, his brother would come and kill her. It was after the attacker had left the house that she was able to push out the bathroom window and crawl to the road. Had she not escaped then, doctors believed, she might well have died from a further round of blood extraction. The house that she described to the police belonged to John Brennan Crutchley, 39, a computer engineer for the Harris Corporation, a NASA contractor. He was married and had one child. Both his wife and child were in Maryland, visiting her family for the holidays. A search warrant was obtained and served on Crutchley's home at 2:30 the next morning. During this serving, Crutchley was arrested. Some obvious items of interest were seized, and photographs were taken of the residence. The hitchhiker initially did not want to file charges against Crutchley, but she was convinced to do so by a rape counselor on the grounds that convicting Crutchley would prevent him from assaulting other women. The victim took and passed a lie detector test about the rapes, and Crutchley was charged with sexual battery, kidnapping, and aggravated battery of the hitchhiker, as well as possession of marijuana and of drug paraphernalia. The well-meaning police search had seized some of the obvious items, such as the video camera, the hook in the ceiling where the hitchhiker had been tied, the marijuana, and some of the other paraphernalia of the assaults. But they had not been in time to prevent the erasure of the sections of videotape. According to the victim, this video would have contained the record of the assault on the hitchhiker. After the search, it was not entirely clear what the police had and what they had missed, nor even what they ought to be looking for in further searches. The police authorities contacted me for assistance, and during a trip to Florida for other purposes, I went to Titusville to render it. I was very glad they asked me to get involved in the case, because while the police knew they had caught a dangerous rapist, after I found out a few things about Crutchley, I thought it probable that they had a serial killer in custody. One of the greatest problems in law enforcement today is that the police don't know how to deal with unusual cases. Specifically, they don't know what to look for at a crime scene. And in a search that doesn't grab everything that could be of interest, time is allowed for the suspect and his associates to hide or destroy what could be of vital importance to the case. It was my task initially to tell the police what to look for in a second search. For instance, the police photographs of Crutchley's house showed a stack of credit cards several inches thick. By the time of the second search, these had been removed and had presumably been destroyed. Those credit cards and such things as the presence of a dozen or more women's necklaces that hung on a hook in Crutchley's closet, and which I thought were trophies, as well as the presence in the house of identification cards from two other women, pointed me in the direction of believing that the abduction of the hitchhiker was not Crutchley's first offense. When asked about these identification cards, Crutchley said he had given rides to the women, and they had left the cards in his car, and he had had no opportunity to return them. He avowed that the necklaces belonged to his wife, and said that the hitchhiker had been a Manson girl who had solicited kinky sex from him. There had been four female bodies found in remote sites in Brevard County during the previous year, and police investigated whether Crutchley might have killed these women, but authorities could find no evidentiary connection between Crutchley and those bodies. The second searches that I recommended included excavations on his property and searches of his offices at the Harris Corporation. These turned up the fact that the stack of credit cards had disappeared, and that Crutchley appeared to have illegal possession of a great deal of highly classified information on naval weaponry and communications. Some of this was on diskettes that he had protected by a code, which authorities were able to break. Other federal agencies considered opening an espionage case against him. We found a stack of 72 3x5-inch cards containing women's first names, their telephone numbers, and Crutchley's evaluation of their sexual performances. Some of these women were telephoned by the authorities, and they gave some indications that they had been restrained or assaulted by Crutchley, but the majority said only that they had participated in kinky behavior with him. There were indications that his wife had done so as well. I insisted that Crutchley's actions be traced back in time. We learned that in 1978, Crutchley had been the last person to see alive Deborah Fitzjohn, a secretary in Fairfax County, Virginia. She had been in his mobile home before her disappearance, and police in Fairfax were investigating whether Crutchley had any connection to her death. No charges were brought. We learned that wherever Crutchley had been in residence, in Pennsylvania, for instance, there were reports of missing women or bodies found in remote locations, though none of these missing person cases have to date been connected to Crutchley. In April of 1986, as the case was ready for trial, Crutchley decided to plead guilty to the kidnap and rape charges in exchange for the dropping of the charges stemming from the blood drinking, grievous bodily harm, and the possession of drugs. After his plea, he held a press conference to downplay what he had done. Echoing his line, his wife later suggested that the crime had been a gentle rape, devoid of any overt brutality. State's attorney Norman Wolfinger asked me to enter the case again at this stage because the state wished to press for a more severe sentence than would normally be given to someone convicted of a first-time charge of kidnap and rape. The usual penalty was 12 to 17 years. With time deducted for good behavior in prison and so on, Crutchley could be out in 4 to 5 years, and the state did not believe that was in society's best interests. I agreed and began to look into the case prior to going to Florida to give testimony at a pre-sentencing hearing. I learned that Crutchley's family was well-educated, but Crutchley's mother had dressed him as a girl until he was 5 or 6 years of age, and there were other instances of childhood abnormalities. Crutchley told a psychiatrist at the time of sentencing that he remembered seeing a psychiatric counselor in his youth. Friends and a former wife said that he liked to control people and would often make them do his bidding, and that he was a sexual sadist. Others said they knew of group sex in which he had been involved. There were indications of his bisexuality, and it was clear from interviews with some of the women named on the 3x5-inch cards that Crutchley was into unlimited sexual experimentation. Such unlimited experimentation was one of the categories of behavior I had documented as being frequently associated with serial killers. In June, the pre-sentencing hearing was held, and the courtroom was packed. The blonde, slight, erudite-appearing Crutchley decided to take the stand in his own defense. In a tearful 2-hour presentation, he said that he was just a sexual experimenter, and that the behavior for which he had been convicted was private and not within the court's jurisdiction. Although the charge stemming from the blood drinking had been dropped from the indictment, it was an issue in the sentencing hearing because it showed how much harm Crutchley had done to his victim. He tried to explain it away by saying that he had learned blood drinking from a nurse 15 years earlier as part of a sexual ritual, and that if the drinking of blood was really important to the sentencing, it should be thrown out, because he hadn't really drunk the blood in this case. Why not? Because it had coagulated, and he couldn't get it down. Such answers, of course, did him very little good. Crutchley admitted that, "I need treatment," which ought not to include extended jail time. His wife sat in the courtroom but would not take the stand in his defense, though she later told reporters that he wasn't really guilty and was just a kinky sort of guy. When I took the stand, as sometimes happens, my credentials were brought into question. The defense attorney was contending that this case was so unusual that no one could claim to be an expert on things of this nature. He asked me how many blood-drinking cases I had seen. I gazed toward the ceiling for a moment and counted them in my mind before saying, "Oh, a half dozen." People in the courtroom gasped. "Which ones?" the defense attorney challenged. I rattled them off, beginning with Richard Trenton Chase. After that demonstration of my experience, I had smooth sailing. I made a strong plea for sentencing that exceeded the guidelines. To go beyond those guidelines, the state had to provide good reasons. In this case, the reasons were that there had been extensive physical and mental injury to the victim, excessive brutality and premeditation of the crime, and taking advantage of a vulnerable victim.